Hi, you are experiencing the Breaking Ground podcast. I'm Steve Hadley, and on this episode, I'll be meeting two experts in the field of geothermal engineering. We can hear from them just after this advert.
At Central Piling, we have a fleet of continuous flight auger, rotary board, and driven rigs of various sizes. This caters for most piling and retaining wall needs. Our team's technical, logistical, and operational strengths provide clients with a flexible and reliable design and build solution across England and Wales. We pride ourselves on understanding the environment within which we work and being a responsible contractor. To ensure greater efficiency and meet our growth targets, we are always developing our people, plant, and services. We now offer a plant and operator hire service, including ancillary equipment. For more details, please visit centralpiling.com or phone 01787 474 000. That's 01787 474 000.
Thanks for joining me on the Breaking Ground podcast. Whether you're a first-time listener, just become aware of it after the tie-up with Ground Engineering and the Ground Forum, or a long-time supporter of the podcast, we are happy to have you. The bounce in listener numbers since the last episode has been amazing, and so the pressure really is on to keep delivering something special and something that will really resonate with our many listeners in the geotechnical community and beyond. With the topic that we got today and the quality of guests, I'm confident that we can do that. Michael Chenderain is Associate Director at TARUP and Global Lead for Geothermal and Groundwater Engineering. And Beam Beanland is the Principal Consultant at BBH Energy, Director of the Heat Pumpers Federation, and how I know him is actually as the past Chair of the Ground Source Heat Pump Association. And he was involved at the Ground Forum, which I'm also involved with. Hello, gentlemen.
Good morning. Hi. How are you today?
I'm really good. I had my, jab on Friday, so it's taken me a couple of days to recover from that, but I'm on the mend, and I'm sure I'll be a lot healthier for it in the future.
Well, the NHS thanks you for helping to take some heat off of them.
Indeed, yeah, and if there's any listeners out there just wondering if it's worth it, then please go out there, get jabs, and improve the health of society. So geothermal energy is something that has intrigued me. I've got involved in bits of it over the years. Going to start out by looking back at some of the uses of geothermal energy through history. And because it's not a new thing. Bean, tell us a little bit about examples of where it's been used in the past.
Well, in this country, we have examples at thermal spas, for example, where we've seen warm water, shall we say, at around about 45 degrees or so, coming to the surface. And I suppose the most obvious one is indeed Bath, which was the Roman baths, where we've seen geothermal heated water coming to the surface for, the Romans started harvesting it 2,000 years ago. So, yeah, so it's nothing new.
Yeah, and of course we can all enjoy the benefits of that if we go down there to Bath and got heated swimming pools, I think, that are open. If that particular project had a few problems, I'm not sure how related they were to the geothermal aspects of the development, but the reopening of it sort of five or six years ago did mean that more people can enjoy some of the benefits of geothermal energy. There's the also in that sort of area, there's the Bath Abbey project. Is that connected to the same development?
Absolutely. That project's now live. I mean, it's a beautiful example of the potential interaction between geothermal energy, as we know it, and ground source heat pumps. So in this particular instance, the Abbey itself has been significantly transformed by having underfloor heating installed. And one of the things in my time in this industry that has actually surprised me is how proactive and receptive the Church of England is to providing faculty, which is the sort of church consent, if you like, to lift the floors in significantly historic buildings and put in underfloor heating. They've been very, very receptive. So Bath Abbey has now got underfloor heating. And the underfloor heating is driven by a ground source heat pump plant room, which is itself driven by the wastewater from the Roman baths. So for the last 2,000 years, the wastewater has been effectively discarded into the river through what is called the Great Drain. The Great Drain is part Roman and part Georgian, and is obviously listed to death. But working with Borough Happold, we managed to get consents to connect the great, to put in some closed loop collectors. And I think we'll discuss the difference between closed and open loop shortly. So closed loop collectors into the flow in the Great Drain, harvesting the thermal energy, using it to drive the ground source heat pump system. And that then is in turn providing the heating fluid into the floor in the abbey. So we've got a rather beautiful 2,000-year-old wastewater heating a building which is getting on for 1,000 years old. It's a super example of the connection between true geothermal and ground source heat pumps.
Okay, well, that sounds a wonderful project that I'm sure there's information out there our listeners can find out more about. There's talking about deeper geothermal. I know that there's a very large project that's been underway for a few years, but the real drilling element of it is just getting underway down in Cornwall, the United Downs project. Michael, I think you've got an awareness of that particular scheme. Can you tell us?
Yeah, and I think it's really interesting too, because when people, you know, we're here to talk about geothermal, and when people think about geothermal, they think about Iceland and New Zealand and places like Indonesia and Philippines, and they don't think about, you know, the United Kingdom as a geothermal place. But, you know, a city like Bath, as Bean mentioned, it just really speaks to the fact that there is geothermal in the UK. And whether it's very deep geothermal or shallower ground energy and ground source heat pumps, you know, there is a lot of opportunity to develop ground energy systems for the UK. And the UK has been looking at it for a long time. I mean, right now they've got two wells in the ground in Cornwall that soon will start to produce electricity and put that electricity into the grid for the UK. And, you know, in Cornwall in particular, they've been looking at that for a long time. I mean, the first research in geothermal wells in the UK was really sort of like mid-80s in Cornwall at the Rosemann Owls project. And, you know, since then, it's been a long, bumpy ride to get to the point where we've got two wells in the ground and they can start producing electricity. And from that success, the really well-known Eden project, the biodomes in Cornwall, are now planning to put some holes in the ground to also develop electricity. So Cornwall in the short term will see a real growth in their renewable energy portfolio. And that's going to include geothermal. And it's going to be the real first production of geothermal electricity that the UK will be successful at, which is, it's just fabulous news.
Okay, let's explore a bit more of that. So first of all, why Cornwall? United Kingdom's a big country. Presumably it's something to do with the type of rocks that are present in Cornwall and yep. their ability to transmit temperatures.
It's really so deep geothermal, you know, comes from, everybody knows you need heat to produce electricity from geothermal. That people are generally aware of that. The other bit that's really important is you can tap down into that heat, but water, this geothermal brine fluid, has to be able to flow back up. So you need to have both the heat and the flow parts in the geology. Cornwall, as far as the UK goes, is one of the best known heat sources in the UK's area. So it has the heat. And then the stopping block, since we've established there's been heat in Cornwall for a very long time, has been, well, is there going to be any water that gets produced when we actually put the wells in? These are not cheap wells. They're very, very expensive. And it's always a guessing game and a mystery whether or not the wells will actually produce fluid. So that's what the last decades of work since the 80s has been really focused on, is to get people invested into the project, both from a technical perspective, but more importantly, from a financial perspective, so that they could actually drill those holes in the ground. to back up, the question is, what is the geology out there that makes it really interesting when you compare it to places like, you know, Indonesia, Iceland? You know, we're talking about volcanic areas, ring of fire, earthquakes, all that sort of stuff. We don't have that in the UK, obviously. So what we have here is hot, dry rocks. So we have granites that have a subsurface source of heat that was related to volcanic activity below the ground surface, where these rocks formed from those very deep heat sources. And those hot, dry rocks, as they call them in most of Europe, are really what produces the heat source for electricity generation. But throughout the rest of the UK, that may not be as fortunate as Cornwall, they can certainly leverage from that success and all of those lessons learned to possibly generate deep geothermal heat. So there's still an opportunity for deep geothermal heat that exists outside of Cornwall too. And then from that, and as being really mentioned from Bath Abbey, which is a really good example of, hey, there is a stream of fluid that has energy in it that can be tapped into that's much shallower and much cheaper to access, that can really drive a lot of the heating and cooling needs for the UK. And so while everybody likes to talk about, you know, deep geothermal and volcanoes and places like Iceland and all of that stuff, there is also a real practical application within the UK that is very well established at this point. As you mentioned, Bean was the former chair of the Ground Source Heat Pump Association. And that's really the ground energy, to use that ground as a battery to store energy, to put heat in the ground in the summertime and extract it back out in the wintertime, to really use that storage capacity in the ground to do a lot of renewable energy good to reduce our carbon footprint in the UK.
Yeah, just reversing back to the deeper system in Cornwall, for instance, you mentioned about the need for groundwater, which I found quite interesting. So you actually need the combination of the two. You need the right rocks with the right temperature, but also groundwater present to have that sort of deep geothermal.
There's no party in deep geothermal if you don't have both. You know, okay. If you don't have, it's sort of like, think about it like you go to a party, you get a drink. If you don't have a cup to put that drink in it, you're going to be out of luck, right? So you think about the fluid, the heat as the drink, and the cup as the ability to produce that fluid. So you have to, and typically, you know, we don't go down 5 kilometers into the ground and find a bunch of sand sitting around in these geothermal reservoirs that we can just put a well in anywhere and pull the water out. We need to have cracks in the rock. So we need to have fractures. And we typically look for faults. And you hear fault, you're like, oh, are we in an earthquake area? Well, there's faults all over the world. But they're not always have the pressures on them that make them very seismically active, generating earthquakes and things like that. But Cornwall has faults. There's faults all over the United Kingdom. And so trying to find those faults and finding the right types of faults that move or don't move in the right way, but have the ability to move fluids through them, is really the name of the game when it comes to deep geothermal.
Okay.
The heat, the BGS has done a fabulous job of mapping the heat in the UK. It's really down to finding where the sweet spots are in terms of flow at this point.
And there might be concerns from people listening when they hear about fracking and some of the dangers related to fracking. So this is trying to produce shale gas.
Yeah.
And there's potentially, and this is, it's arguable, but potentially detrimental environmental impacts from trying to create this shale gas. Similar implications?
Yeah, absolutely. There's similar things. The difference really is going to watch a Premier League game and going to the park on Saturday and watching a bunch of 5-year-olds kick the football around. I mean, that's the scale and magnitude of difference when we're talking about stimulating a geothermal well and a shale gas play. And there's a lot of real important distinctions there. First of all, yeah, we can stimulate wells for geothermal operations. In fact, the guys in Cornwall, that's what they did. They pushed fluid into the ground to improve the permeability, the actual ability to flow fluid in the ground. And the whole game they're trying to do is to optimize how they get the water out of the ground. So they push fluid down into the ground, they pressurize the ground, and they generated earthquakes. I think they got up to 1.7 magnitude, maybe. For someone like me who lived, you know, half my life in California, I don't even, that's a joke, you know, for someone like me. But for someone who doesn't experience earthquakes, they'll hear it. They heard the earthquakes. They saw their windows rattle a little bit down in Cornwall. And so they were aware that, you know, seismic activity happened. There's been seismic activity all over the world related to geothermal stimulation. So it's something that has to be carefully managed. And there are ways to manage it. You can never control earthquakes. You shouldn't even try to pretend like you can control earthquakes, but you can manage the risk associated with it. And the other thing to note about earthquakes is you can only create an earthquake as big as what you would naturally create. So, you know, the UK doesn't run around with a whole lot of magnitude 5, magnitude 6, magnitude 7, you know, catastrophic disaster earthquakes. We don't have the geology to generate that, but we can generate earthquakes up to what we would naturally produce. So we have to be very careful managing it. The real thing is not just the seismicity. There's all the other baggage that comes with shale gas that doesn't happen in a geothermal project. So you might have a few, maybe two wells at a geothermal site. Well, a shale gas play, you know, in your shale gas concession, you hope you'll have thousands. So everything is already several orders of magnitude greater in a shale gas play versus a geothermal play. The other bit is all the environmental issues. Where do you take all of this water that gets generated? All of these chemicals that are used to improve the rheology of the well fluid that you're pushing into the ground. These chemicals can interact with the aquifers that we use to drink, that we get our potable water supply from. So we have to be very careful about all the chemicals that go into the ground for a shale gas activity. That also makes you have to think about, oh, is this well actually installed right? You know, is it going to leak? You know, I mean, in a geothermal project where you're not dealing with these chemicals, where you only have a handful of wells, the pressures that we apply for a geothermal project versus a shale gas project is also very different, a lot less pressure. You can see very quickly that, you know, it's a bunch of 5-year-olds playing football in the park versus, you know, the premiership and the level of scale we're talking about there.
Yeah.
So while people
thank you, Imago. I mean, that is reassuring in terms of my holiday in Devon. I'll carry on with that without the fear of a major earthquake.
What it has done, Steve, is it's stimulated conversations amongst community groups who have been asking, well, if we've been drilling some fracking wells and then we decide against fracking, can they be repurposed into geothermal wells? And of course, that is very geology specific and unlikely, but it's interesting that the community groups are recognizing that there's an environmental difference between fracking and geothermal energy.
Well, it's a key message to get out there. The focus we just spent the last few minutes on there is about deep geothermal and basically taking that heat energy and transferring it into electricity. Where I've previously been personally involved in geothermal is more in the ground source side of it, I suppose, or at least, but there's so many different names for this, so energy piles, heat exchangers, certainly quite shallow geothermal solutions, basically taking piles, putting some plastic pipework in it and using it to regulate the temperatures of buildings. Michael, are you seeing much use of that throughout the structures that you're involved with at Arup?
Yeah, there's a lot more interest in ground energy. The interest in ground energy just keeps increasing. From what we see, my company is, sort of on the low side of a large consulting firm. There's 15,000 people globally at AirUp. It's a UK-based company originally. I'm here in London as well. We see that these large commercial projects and large infrastructure projects, HS2, all of these sorts of things, there's a real big interest that's growing to integrate ground energy into their project strategies. We see that at airports as well. A lot of airports are very interested in ground energy projects. They've got themselves a massive decarbonization problem. So they're trying to do anything they can do to reduce their carbon footprint.
Yeah, so they're using it as an offset route. And same on the railway side of things. I think Crossrail were trying to use it to regulate the temperature within their stations. And there was the other infrastructure projects. I think it's certainly part of the solution. Sorry to take it back to piling. I think it's always my default position, but there is some good papers out there. The last episode was on the Piling 2020 conference. I want to highlight a couple of the papers from that. One was by Turner Loveridge et al. And they were talking about a project that they'd done for Siemens, a building called the Crystal Building in London. And they were looking at how the temperature in those piles had varied from 10 degrees to 30 degrees. So they're actually able to monitor the temperature in the piles. And they'd, as I explained at the outset, use the temperatures in the ground to help with the cooling and the heating of the building in the summer and winter respectively. And they actually provide some information within that paper about the potential tons of CO2 emissions that could be saved from employing a solution like that. Interestingly, that there's another paper as well. The keynote by Sakrovich and the Imperial College team, which was looking at modelling the stresses on, they term thermoactive piles from temperature changes. Michael, have you seen much conjecture within your team over the effects of temperature changes on the structural capacity of piles?
Yeah, we as part of our design work, whenever we do energy piles, we have to evaluate what the reduction in structural capacity could be from the thermal cycling of the piles, from the fluids going through it. And that's taken into account in the design, because at the end of the day, these are structural piles and they have to hold building up.
How significant are we talking? Are we saying we need another 5 newtons strength on the concrete mix? What sort of magnitude of impact could we be looking at? Or does it all depend on how many pipes you've got?
It depends on a lot of factors. It depends on the overall design of the structural piles and what they're trying to do. We see that, you think about a pile and, okay, it's going to heat up and expand and it's going to cool down and shrink ever so slightly. But really what that relates to is the relationship to stress and strain in the soil that it's around, that's surrounding it. So we've been fortunate that we've had some projects where we could put a lot of kit down in some piles and we could load it with heating and cooling while we also loaded it. We did a pile load test and put some weight on it as well. So we could see where the change in the pile capacity was happening. Was it happening along the sides of the piles, or was this at the bottom of the pile or the top of the pile? So if I recall off the top of my head, we saw most of it was the force down as it pushed and pulled against the bottom. We did see some of the its relationship to the soil along the pile as well.
Mm. So it affected the geotechnical capacity as well as the structural capacity.
It's relationship with the soil is what's happening, and its ability to utilize the soil as a structural element as part of its overall design. So, I'm not a geotechnical engineer, and I've got a lot of geotechnical engineers around me to remind me of that every day. but what I can say is that from the modeling work we did for the projects that we've done thermal piles, we haven't had to change the pile design at all.
Okay.
Okay. So it was able to the net impact was not anything within the factor of safeties that we looked at ourselves and said, oh, we've got an issue here. We have to we have to really evaluate the cost, the benefit of doing this or not. So it's more the structural engineers want to know because they want to be satisfied that it's not going to impact the overall goals of the project. I think we're talking about a few percentage when we've done very detailed numerical modeling. We've used finite element models that are looking at all of the soil structural interactions, mm-hmm. Including the thermal cycling. So, also been some good papers on it, I think, as well.
I mentioned the one by Zagrovich there, but I'm sure there'll be plenty of references within that paper that people can find. It must also be important to work with a consultant and the right sort of contractor to identify just how many of these piles should have the geothermal pipework, because there must be a limit to how much energy you can take up, and each pile has probably got a circumference of where it could take its energy from, and you could end up overlapping and actually becoming quite inefficient in the design of where you're placing these geothermal elements.
These are not the cheapest things to do in the world. So you definitely want to be cost effective, and you don't want to stick so much stuff in there that you're just sort of wasting money. There's really reasonable tools to evaluate the capacity of the ground to provide heating and cooling. So that part can be designed reasonably well. Closed loop systems like these piles we're talking about, they're relatively predictable. The ground in the UK, the shallow ground, we know a lot about it. We know what its thermal performance is, generally speaking. You know, we're not trying to find groundwater or fractures or crazy things like in these deep geothermal projects or open loop projects where we have to be able to still produce water. So for closed loop projects, they're relatively predictable. And, the spacing of these things, that's relatively easy to establish is also, yes. It really comes down to the user, how they're going to use the system. Like I mentioned earlier, we look at it like a little storage box. The ground's a storage box. So in the summer, you dump heat from the building into the ground, and that box can hold so much heat. And in the winter, you take that heat back out and put it into the building. So if you, over 50 years of using your building, you put too much heat in the ground in the summer, you overheat the ground, and then you stop being able to put any more heat back in. So you've lost the ability to use it for cooling. And if that's what you need it for, that's sort of a big problem. So you have to really understand how big is your battery or your storage box to know what you can use it for in your building.
We did promise at the beginning to define what an open and a closed loop system is. Could you just remind us of that, please, Michael?
Yeah, closed loop system is just a bunch of pipes in the ground and fluid moves through the pipes. It's all closed. No fluid goes out of the pipes into the ground. In an open loop system, you have groundwater down there. I mean, I live in London. I've got limescale issues everywhere in my house because we take groundwater out of the chalk aquifer, and that chalk mm-hmm. just generates a whole lot of limescale everywhere. And so we can take that groundwater from the chalk aquifer in London, pull it out of the ground, pass it through a heat exchanger heat pump, and we can extract some energy from that moving fluid, or we can put some heat back into that fluid and put it back into the ground.
Terrific. And because one is recirculating it and the other isn't, that's the change in the definition.
Yeah, one is actively using groundwater, so it's an open system. So the fluid is part of nature that we use. So that's why it's open. And closed is we're just putting water through a pipe.
Yeah, so the heat exchanger in a closed loop scenario is in the ground, and the heat exchanger in an open loop scenario is up in the plant room, effectively. And I think the other thing to make people understand here is that when we talk about these various technologies and differential technologies, so thermal piling, open loop, closed loop boreholes, for any given building, it's not necessarily one or the other. in many instances, we are now combining these technologies together. So if you cannot get the thermal capacity, either for cooling or heating, that the building requires from the thermal piling alone, you can combine that with some deeper, either open or closed loop boreholes to add to the capacity, because the piling boreholes will be relatively shallow in our terms, whereas open and closed loop wells, open loop wells in London are sort of 120 to 150, 160 meters maybe to get into the aquifer below the London clay. But in closed loop scenarios in London, we are now routinely drilling to 200 meters. And there are people now looking at going significantly deeper. And we bear in mind that the definition, the sort of European directive definition between what is geothermal and what is ground source, effectively stops at 500 meters below the ground. So, yeah, so it's this combination of technologies that we can use, because many commercial buildings now, of course, are cooling dominant. So the rationale for putting these systems into urban environments like London and the other big cities is principally being driven by cooling, because we still got cheap gas to provide the heating. So we don't need, it's the cooling bit that's the really valuable piece. So what we're going to, I think, move to is a situation where we'll be much more interactive between buildings. So rather than trying to treat buildings in isolation, because if your building is heavily dominant in either one or the other, it means that charging and recharging your thermal battery, which is the ground around the site, becomes a problem long term, because you're dominant one way or the other. So what we need to start looking for is situations where we can share thermal properties, share thermal resources in a much more proactive way. And so you'll see buildings being connected to networks where the building itself may have its own infrastructure, but then it will connect to a network to be able to provide, if the building is cooling dominant, it can share heat with a building alongside that needs, more heat than. So yeah. I think we're going to see a lot more of that.
Well, there's clearly a practical and financial benefit from being able to use it. But I think what's interesting to lots of people, including myself, is that geothermal potentially can be a big part of our route to zero carbon. And I don't know if either of you are able to answer this. To what extent is it currently meeting the UK energy demands? And where do we see that going? Have we got a feel for that at all?
It's tiny. The penetration at the moment of the technology in the UK is absolutely tiny. And there are lots of sort of deeply entrenched reasons for that. Not, and it certainly isn't because the UK isn't suitable. I mean, actually, from a ground source perspective, the UK is actually very well suited, because we have relatively benign winters. It doesn't get that cold. It doesn't really get that hot here either. And we tend to have wet winters, so the ground is wet. And broadly speaking, wet ground equals better opportunities for being able to harvest heat. So we're really well suited in that respect. The reason why our ground source economy is so low in the UK at the moment is because we have been relying for the last 60, 70 years on extremely cheap gas. So you'd say, well, why bother with these other technologies which are more expensive? Because we weren't worrying about the environmental cost of burning fossil fuels. And of course, that situation has changed. If you look at Sweden, where the cost of a kilowatt hour of electricity and a kilowatt hour of fossil fuel, be it gas, oil, whatever, is broadly the same, the incentive to use a heat pump is extraordinarily high. And so they have very high penetration of heat pump technology. Whereas in the UK, we don't have that. We've always had this differential in price between electricity and gas. So there's been very little driving the use of heat pump technology. And it's the heat pump technology that drives the use of the ground as a battery, a thermal battery. And we talk about batteries a lot. Batteries are a very sort of sexy subject at the moment. And in most instances, of course, it's being talked about in terms of electrical batteries. But for Michael and I, the big battery is the one we stand on.
In the ground, yeah, to retain that heat. Of course, gas is, it will run out, and we do need to look at other sources of energy. How does it compare with something like wind? Wind, you know, it's not always windy. We can't rely on wind. Presumably, we can always rely, once we've set that well up, we can always rely on that geothermal energy to be there, and we can call it off as and when our energy demands it. So if we're all putting the kettle on at halftime in the World Cup final, you know, we can make an allowance for that within geothermal energy projects, which we can't necessarily do within wind energy.
I think it's a really interesting point. There's two types of energy, really. There's baseload energy and peak energy. And the kettle halftime at the World Cup is peak energy. But ground energy is just fabulous at producing baseload renewable energy. And it's one of, you know, it's really, there's not really anything else that compares to its ability to produce baseload energy in the renewable sector. It's got to be sunny for solar. It's got to be windy for wind. You've got to have water dammed up for hydro projects. So it has that uniqueness to it, and that makes it a really special place in the overall energy portfolio to transition away from fossil fuels.
The other thing, Steve, I think you need to remember in your example with the kettles on, we've got two ways, of course, of dealing with that peak load. You can deal with peak load by bringing on more capacity to cope with the peak, or you can deal with the peak by switching off something else. And if we are intelligently using ground source to store thermal energy, whether it's warmth or coolth at the surface, we can manage those peak loads by switching heat pumps off. So there is a growing now market, and it is a market, for demand side response and demand side management, where instead of relying on peaking plant and batteries to be able to throw more juice into the network when required, actually we can manage constraints in demand and constraints in transmission capacity in the electricity grid by switching heat pump systems off. And this is starting obviously in large commercial systems where you get much more bang for your buck, but we will increasingly see this moving down into the domestic arena. And in fact, the entry point for domestic properties on ground source heat pumps for accessing this sort of flexibility value are time of use tariffs. And people are becoming increasingly used to time of use tariffs because of charging electric vehicles. And so in your wind scenario, one of the options is we use the excess wind capacity in heat pumps overnight, we charge thermal stores at the surface or indeed in the ground, we can use both. And that then gives us a flexibility mechanism which we can use during the day to manage constraints on the grid. So the whole thing, I think the one message here is that many of these technologies are now interacting in a way which is becoming increasingly complex, but the value of which we're only now beginning to recognize because we have belatedly woken up to the fact that burning fossil fuels is actually not doing either us or the planet much good.
Yeah. So what I'm hearing is it might never be the lowest average cost energy, but it's an important part of our energy mix, and it can help reduce the overall cost of energy and clearly is an important part of our route to zero carbon.
Yeah, in today's pricing, with sort of retail pricing, if we think about the retail market at the moment, if you've got really well-performing ground source systems, you can actually provide thermal energy at a lower cost than burning gas. But it has to be really well-performing ground source, the way that we structure the price of utilities at the moment. And one of the issues here is that, and these are political choices, of course, the level of environmental and social levies applied to gas are currently running at just under 2% of the total price, whereas the environmental levies and social levies for electricity are currently running at 23% of the total cost. So, you know, we've made a political choice over the years to load the price of electricity. And if we're serious about decarbonising, then that is one of the elements that potentially we've got to consider changing in the future. And you know, that's a huge political decision because of the issues around fuel poverty and what have you, which have to be taken into account. So, you know, we're beginning to stray into the politics of...
Well, I'm glad we are, because it was the next topic, really, in terms of some of the legal and financial implications. So what grants are there available to individuals or to businesses that want to undertake geothermal works? Can we go out there and get our geothermal well in the garden funded by the government?
I'm not sure about deep geothermal. I mean, there is support for deep geothermal, primarily because of the, if you're producing electricity from deep geothermal, i.e. you're getting your temperature back at the surface is sufficiently high that you can use it to generate electricity. If it's just thermal energy, that is a more difficult proposition. The answer to your question is that subsidies and grants have been coming and going over the last decade. Everybody, I'm sure, listening will be familiar with the most recent Green Homes Grant debacle.
I wouldn't assume that they are, Bean. Go on and give us a quick summary.
The Green Homes Grant is very specific, actually, and it's probably not the best example. It was created, actually, as part of the COVID response to try and pump money into the economy in a very short timescale. The problem from our technology, of course, is that we don't operate on a short-term timescale. You can imagine that it takes years to develop the theoretical models for effective deep geothermal, and then you've got, you know, a drilling program which could be measured in months, and so having support mechanisms that are measured literally in weeks or months doesn't help that technology at all. And to some extent, we've got the same problem with relatively shallow ground source projects, even horizontal ground source projects, which can take, you know, many months from concept to delivery. And so short-term grants and mechanisms have not been that helpful. The renewable heat incentive is probably the best example. So that was designed to support all heat-generating renewable technologies, so solar, thermal, biomass, ground source, and indeed air source, so all heat pumps. And that was a relatively long-term program, but the problem that we had in our industry was that the tariffs that were established right at the front end were not conducive to people investing in heat pump technology, and even to this day. So the non-domestic version of the RHI started in 2011, so we're 10 years on, and even now something in the region of 97% of total funding has gone to some form of biomass fuel, whether it's biomass pellets, chip, or whether it's biogases. But a tiny proportion of the support has come the way of the heat pump industry. And we've just been beginning to make that support work in the last 4 or 5 years, and the scheme is now closed. So we are looking to Treasury, and we're doing a lot of work with Treasury to try and get them to appreciate the long-term value that ground source technology can deliver to the UK. And it is long-term because what we're putting in the ground is infrastructure. You know, this is every bit as high quality infrastructure as a gas main, a water main, sewage mains. The pipework we're putting in the ground has longevity. We're 100 to 140 odd years. I think German research is out at about 140 years. So this is real infrastructure. And what it does is it's displacing imported gas fundamentally. So it has both fuel security and balance of payments implications. And those things need to be taken into account. You know, we've got other benefits. If we're stopping burning gas in the urban environment, we are reducing levels of air pollution. 25% of air quality issues in the urban environment is caused by burning gas, not vehicles. 75% for vehicles, but 25%. So even if we converted every vehicle to electric tomorrow, we'd still have an air pollution problem. So there's and that's reflected in the cost of the NHS. You know, so there's all sorts of implications here. We haven't yet arrived at the right mix, I believe, of funding incentives and regulatory / legislative rationale that says we are going to start reducing the carbon emissions from buildings by regulation. So we need this. At the moment, we're in a phase where we need this approach, which is a two-horse approach. So there's some stick and some carrot, and getting that balance right is tricky.
Yeah, indeed. And just reverting back to our example of the deep geothermal well in the garden, who actually owns the energy? Michael, come to you. Where's the legal responsibility? Is it that distinction that we were talking earlier about, sort of the shallow and sort of ground source and deep geothermal distinction? Is that where the distinction lies in terms of legal ownership of geothermal wells? Because it's not like I can, let's say there's coal underneath my house. It's not like I can go and dig a mine underneath and start extracting coal, is it? Is it a similar sort of principle with geothermal energy?
Yeah, I think with ground energy, everything is very complicated because there's not a lot of track record in this area. And so the government hasn't had a real priority to deal with it because, you know, you've got two holes in the ground in Cornwall, and that's it right now. And that's the entire industry. And then there'll be another two holes in Cornwall soon. So you'll have four holes in all of the United Kingdom for electricity. So it's not, they've got other problems to solve. You know, for deep geothermal, it's a let's wait and see sort of approach. I think everybody's taking to see how it plays out. For shallow geothermal, it's also really interesting because, you know, the Environment Agency has a remit to ensure that if someone has a license to pull groundwater out of the ground, an abstraction license, then the Environment Agency takes that agreement with that license holder very seriously. And they want to ensure that no one else can impact their ability to produce that water. So if you go next door to them and you put an abstraction license in, they're going to look at it an application for an abstraction license, they're going to look at it very carefully. And so they're going to regulate other operators, other potential open loop operators, on the basis of the impacts to the existing license holders that they have agreements with. So that's when you deal with the open loop system of pulling water out of the ground actively. With a closed loop system, the EA sort of holds their nose and closes their eyes, and they don't have much in terms of a regulatory remit to deal with closed systems. So if we're not careful as an industry, and whether it's the ground energy industry or the developer industry, we could start to see problems in terms of people overlapping on each other's ability to utilize these batteries or storage boxes. Luckily, it is somewhat constrained within the site, especially if it's operated correctly, because you're trying to take heat out in the summer, heat out in the winter and put it back in the summer. So if your system's working well, you know, there's not a lot of bleed out into your neighbors. And so that will minimize the constraint. And that's probably why the EA, other than maybe it's just not, you know, the size of the scope is, as Bean said earlier, we're talking about peanuts in terms of the overall energy usage within the UK. So it's a little vague on who owns the energy down there. It's a bit of first come, first serve.
I'm excited by the ambiguity. I think maybe geothermal will be the next gold rush, and this is how we're going to become billionaires within the industry.
You think that's the case, Bean? We'll be billionaires?
I'm not booking my holidays just yet.
I haven't put an offer on a Ferrari yet.
Okay. Well, we've all got to learn a lot more about this topic, and we've spoken about those high-profile projects going on at the moment, but what other research is there out there? If people want to go and find out more about geothermal, where should I point them towards?
I don't have a good answer to that. I just sort of learned on the fly. I had a really smart, there's a really smart Arup fellow named Duncan Nicholson that Bean knows very well, and he just dumped it all on me when I started at Arup, and thank goodness he's a very smart guy, and I just learned from him.
Yeah, I think that
Yeah, go ahead.
Well, I think there are sort of two schools here, aren't there? The deep geothermal piece, there's a lot of academic work going on. So several universities have got some really strong centres on investigative research into deep geothermal.
Yeah, Durham is a strong center. Campbell School of Mines historically has supported a lot of the work done in Cornwall. I don't know if they're actually doing it so much now, but they've got the track record and life experience on it. I know Durham is very, very interested in it as well. And I think there's a few other schools.
There are centers in Leeds. There are centers down in Portsmouth, I believe. So, you know, there's a lot of academic work going on. And previously, of course, it was sort of academic for its own sake. But now we are beginning to value this energy rather more. Suddenly it's academia that has real commercial value, which is absolutely vitally important.
Yeah, well, Leeds and, of course, Imperial were behind two of the papers that I mentioned earlier. But both of those were in collaboration with industrial partners. So it's exactly what you're saying. And talking of academia, it will clearly play a part in attracting people into geotechnics, geology, construction, civil engineering at university. We know that young people are interested in the environment, and I feel that geothermal can play a huge, maybe a disproportionate part in actually attracting people in, because they see that we can, as an industry, be part of the solution to some of the climate change problems that we have, and reducing carbon. And it's just from an engineering point of view, it's some really interesting technologies available there. Bean, I think you've already done some work with universities through the Ground Source Heat Pump Association. I think there was some lesson blocks you were producing.
Yes, indeed. So I think there's a view here that we've got to catch them early. And switching young people on to the heat pump sector is really, really important. So you asked about the relative scale. I mean, the heat pump industry in the UK is tiny. The ground source heat pump industry is tiny, tiny. Currently, ground source represents about 10% of the total heat pump market in the UK. My personal view, because of the unique nature of the UK that we talked about earlier, is that we are going to see the ground source side of the industry, of the heat pump sector, grow rather more as the industry as a whole grows, for all the good reasons about the infrastructural value. You know, there is real value for UK PLC and the UK taxpayer to invest in the infrastructural value of ground source. But to start to bring through the practitioners of the future, you're absolutely right. So the Ground Source Heat Pump Association, and we started this off last year while I was still in the chair, and Laura Bishop, who now chairs the Ground Source Heat Pump Association, has carried this work forward with a team, and they've been producing lesson blocks that fit straight into the national curriculum. And they've actually started at primary school level. So this runs right the way through. And the intent was that we get to GCSEs and we have, we're starting to introduce the concept of getting involved in the heat pump sector at GCSE level, when people are making their choices for the first choice point for their careers. And as you know, children are, they're digital natives. It's all thumbs, it's all electronic, it's connected, it's all in the cloud. For them, that all comes naturally. And the great thing about heat pump technology, of course, that is exactly where we are. You know, all of our heat pumps they're internet connected. We can control them you can sit with your laptop in your bedroom like an IT engineer and service heat pumps these days. So we're tapping into something which is already innate for these children. You know, they're digital natives, and we're tapping into them, and we have this phrase, digital, not dirty. So instead of dirty fossil fuels, we've got clean digital energy that we can harvest using our ground source tools, and we use the heat pumps in an intelligent way to maximize the value of the interaction with the electricity grid, because that's really where it comes. So we then tie that education program into T-levels and into university, and hopefully it will draw through the next generation of practitioners, engineers, technicians who will see heat pumps very much as a future career opportunity. And for existing practitioners who are already in the fossil fuel sector, we have a sort of business continuity value here where, you know, the nature of the UK industry, particularly heating and the heating industry for housing, is based around small, very small micro businesses. You know, we have tens of thousands of micro businesses, you know, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 practitioners within a business. Many of them are family owned. And so one of the opportunities here is to say, look, if you are migrating from fossil fuels to heat pump technology, that is a business continuity opportunity. It's not actually necessarily being sold as it's a carbon thing, it's an environmental thing, but it's saying, actually, you want your business to continue for the next generation and the generation thereafter. It is now time to start thinking about migrating across.
Clearly. So it's not just STEM to try and try and bring people into careers. It's actually everybody needs to be a stakeholder in this. Let's educate them about the benefits. So, sold. So there'll be STEM ambassadors listening. I know some of the, particularly the early careers groups that are associated with the Ground Forum that will be checking this podcast out, will be going to talk to schools. How can they get hold of those lesson plans and so on?
You go straight to the Ground Source Heat Pump Association and the secretariat there. You can contact Laura or the secretariat, and they will absolutely put STEM ambassadors. And we've had them. They've been put into sort of various sort of test beds, if you like, with teachers looking at them, and the response has been phenomenally good. Brilliant. Because no one else is really creating this sort of material yet. And the fact that we're sort of trying to pick up on, it's not education for its own sake. This is education because it's what we need, because we've got to try and encourage people to want to give up fossil fuels. And we need it because we need the practitioners of tomorrow. So there's a commercial reality here. And at the end of the day, at the moment, you know, if you're taking an apprenticeship and you're offered the module between gas and the module with renewable technologies, the industry is still dominated by gas. We need to switch that around so that people can see there's a long-term market, and this is where we're back to long-term policy. There's a long-term market that, so the young people are saying, actually, the career in gas is you know, there may be one today, but actually 10 years time, what I need to do is to move into the new world where we're getting involved in the heat pump sector, because that is where the growth is going to be, and that's where the jobs for tomorrow are going to be centered. I'm actually very optimistic. I think if we can get it right, the opportunities are immense, and we can create genuine new employment here. You know, if you look at the way that we're harvesting waste energy, putting it into ground source heat pump systems in East Anglia with these new greenhouse horticultural facilities, you know, that one project in East Anglia has created 350 full-time jobs, plus a whole load of seasonal work. And that's new employment in the UK that we weren't able to do before because we couldn't heat the greenhouses cost-effectively. Now we can, because we're harvesting heat pump technology, we can create new employment. So it's not just about employment in the sector itself. We can actually use the sector to create new employment in other walks of life. So I'm very optimistic, but yeah, we've got an immense challenge at the moment to get that policy right. And that's where, you know, the trade bodies are really leveraging the level of interest that we're seeing right across the UK at the moment. So
thank you, Bean. I know you could talk about this subject for all day, and thank you for doing so eloquently today, and Michael for giving us such technical insight into this emerging technology. So yeah, if any of our listeners have got any questions, then I'll be posting on LinkedIn. I'll put Michael and Bean's contact details on there so they can always come to you and ask a question about the topics that we covered. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Yep, thank Always you happy much. To talk to anybody.
If you've enjoyed listening, please share with your contacts and colleagues. I really feel that these podcasts can be a force for good in our industry and facilitate professional development opportunities. If there's a subject or a guest you think we should have on, please send it across. You can find me on LinkedIn. Thanks. Bye-bye.